Order. It's 1:29 on the afternoon of Wednesday, March 21st, 2012. We're going to go ahead and get kicked off. This is the end of the session. You got to get started ahead of time. And we have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Passman is here, Vice Chair Senator Wilkowski, myself, Senator French. We're going to take up some confirmations first, and then we're going to get to some legislation that's been sitting in the committee for some time. So I hope to move some bills today. Let's turn to Regina Chenault, who is up for us to be confirmed to the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. Dr. Chenault, are you there?
Oh, okay.
We could start with Mr. Stark.
Why don't we bring Mr. Stark up? Yeah. And let's let the record reflect that Senator Coghill's joined us. Sorry, Senator, we got started 1 minute early, but we weren't intending to leave without you. We were just wanting to get going. Mr. Stark, welcome. Nice to see you again.
Thank you.
You're up for confirmation of the parole board. You're on the parole board now?
I am. I've served 2 5-year terms on the parole board, and that followed a 27-year career with the Department of Law.
And go ahead and put yourself on the record just so we don't omit the formality.
Michael Stark. I'm actually vice chair of the parole board. For the last 22 years of that 27-year career with the Department of Law, I was lead counsel to the Department of Corrections and the parole board itself for the last 15 years. And very much looking forward to a third 5-year term on the board if the legislature sees fit.
Excellent. You've served 2 5-year terms. What more do you have to learn about the parole board? Why should we send you back there?
I don't know about learning about the board, but learning what makes people who commit crimes tick. It's a long process. I mean, I'm 37 years in the criminal justice system now. And, I mean, first of all, you should all know there's enough success stories that it's worthwhile, you know, with the effort.
I mean, the parole board personally reviews every application for parole out of the prison system.
That's a good question, because only about a third of what the parole board does is entertain applications for discretionary parole. The let me out early, I've been good, stereotypical parole that you hear about in movies, you know, or whatnot. Two-thirds of what we do actually are revocation hearings. Most of those are mandatory parolees, and as you may know, people who get sentenced to 2 years or longer for committing crimes, whether or not they're granted discretionary parole or even eligible under our presumptive sentencing system, they earn good time, and typically one-third unless they violate rules while incarcerated. And so they get out and serve that period of good time on mandatory parole. So in a 3-year sentence, they would serve 2 years inside and 1 year on the street on mandatory parole. And so two-thirds of what the board does actually is revocation hearings, and we decide what to do when somebody violates. Typically, it's a technical. Occasionally, it'll be new crimes, as you know. With the range of options, obviously, from a slap on the wrist to putting them back in prison for the rest of their time, or treatment programs, and that's typically our approach, what will help address their criminogenic needs.
And what are the most difficult decisions that come to you? What for you, what's the most difficult sort of decision about revoking or not revoking?
And it's really the same decision as letting somebody out early.
Right.
And that is risk to the public. I mean, that's always our number one priority. Most of these people are going to get out at some point, even if they do all their time. So we want to give them tools to succeed. So it's the balancing of what's making them most likely succeed versus what kind of risk they present. And ultimately, if the risk is too great, you know, we keep them in, or we require them to do programs in before they're allowed out. But that's the I think the most significant question is how do we balance public safety?
Senator Coghill.
First of all, thank you for your service, and appreciate your long time service and your willingness to serve. One of the things that we worked on is recidivism, and we were trying to figure out. So from your perspective on good time, do we hear enough of what goes on with good time programmatically, or is it just a matter of keeping your nose clean? Are there things that we could do to make that that good time something more significant?
Well, currently, and for, I don't know, since the mid-80s when the latest amendments were made to the good time statute, it's awarded automatically as long as you don't violate the rules. So going in, if you just keep your nose clean, you're going to get out after serving two-thirds of your sentence. And what you're talking, I guess, is really whether you want to make it an incentive, whether you have to do something positive to be awarded that. And years ago, they had that system. They actually had a complicated system of meritorious good time and extra meritorious good time. And I have to tell you, the headaches that it created and the bookkeeping mistakes, the people getting out late or early, I don't know that it's worth it. I think it's a good system. It does in itself act as an incentive to stay out of trouble. So it wouldn't be my recommendation that you tamper with that at this point.
It's a good history lesson. Thank you.
Further questions from Mr. Stark?
It's just one.
Senator Pastor.
You know, you list Justice Carpinetti as one of your references here, and, you know, we heard an excellent speech on smart justice.
I totally support what he said.
Yeah, and, you know, how does that fit with your job on the parole board?
Well, it's interesting because the parole board is going through a transition. The board members and staff went through a very exciting training last September, which touched on a lot of the evidence-based practices that Chief Justice Carpinetti referred to, mm-hmm. and we are going in the same direction. We are revving up to update all our guidelines, the sanctions, and focusing on what are the criminogenic needs of the offender. What's going to make them succeed? What's going to avoid bringing them back to prison? Which is what, you know, the bottom line, at least in many respects, besides public safety, it's the cost to all of us in Alaska. Mm-hmm. So we're going in the same direction. It's going to take some time to make that transition. We have some training, more training to face and so on. But I think it's very exciting. We actually have a method to our madness, if you will. You know.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, I think, thank you, Mr. Stark, for being here. I think we'll wait and make the one big motion for the
thank you.
Seven nominees we have. So thanks for being here. Let's turn to Dr. Chenault, who's on the line.
Yes.
Dr.
Thank you.
Chenault, welcome to the committee. You've been on the put yourself on the record and tell us why you want to continue serving on the Violent Crimes Compensation Board.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. My name is Regina Chenault. I'm a trauma surgeon in Anchorage, and I've served on the board, Violent Crimes Compensation Board, for several terms now under several governors, and I value the service that the board provides. I'm the physician member, so I'm honored to continue to serve on that board and help take care of Alaskans in need.
Dr. Chenault, I am very familiar with your work. You and I have met probably every single year since you've been appointed back in 2005. I just want to say thank you for your continued service. The state is lucky to have someone with your skills sitting in that position.
Well, Senator, thank you very much. I want to thank you for all the support and all of you in there that help us on the Violent Crimes Board. We always, you guys are always thanking us, but I think I forget to say thank you to all of you who help us every time we come down there in need of assistance. So I do appreciate all of you.
Further questions for Dr. Chenault? Senator Wilkowski.
Just same comments, Mr. Chairman. I've had the privilege to meet with Dr. Chenault the last few years, and I always really appreciate her advocacy, and she's very passionate about what she does, and it's we need more public servants like her who are willing to step forward and give her their time. So thank you, Regina.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir.
Senator Coghill.
My gratitude also. So this brings up another term. Looks like you would get confirmed. And with your history, probably the same question I asked of the parole, what are some of the things that you see structurally that need to be done better, or is there something that you see you can be done better through this board?
Senator Coghill, yeah, that's a hard question.
You don't have to answer it. It's just that we're always looking for how we can serve those victims better, and I know that you bring the report in. I'm grateful for that. I just thought if there was something that was hot on your list of things to do, I wanted to know what it was.
There was one thing that we did, thanks for reminding me, actually, that we did one time so far. We had a board meeting up in Fairbanks, and we went to Stevie's place, and we went to the shelter, and we actually met with some of the people and held our board meeting there and had some local other agencies come talk to us about their needs and concerns. So we had talked about maybe instead of always having our meeting either in Juneau or Anchorage, maybe trying to do more outreach like that, because I think that was pretty helpful on all sides of the problem of domestic violence and violent crimes. It brought a greater understanding to me about Steve's place in Fairbanks and what's going on up there and what the needs are for the people. So I would maybe say expanding our scope to do a little bit more outreach than we have been doing in the past.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I don't see any further questions. Dr. Schnell, thanks so much for being here. And as I say, we're going to do one big motion at the end of all the nominees.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's turn to Brad Reich. If Mr. Reich is available, is Mr. Reich online? Okay, how about Robert Sheldon? Mr. Sheldon. Mr. Sheldon, are you there? It's hearing like you're trying to talk to us. Start something else. Let's just try for one more. Is any prospect of getting the folks online? Any way to? Yeah, I'm asking you, is there anybody online right now?
There's no one on this list.
Okay, great. Then we will set them aside.
Senator
Wilikowski.
Did the people call in and just not get online or just not show up?
Actually, let's take that short.
Mr. Chair, I'm online. My name is Ron Taylor.
Oh, okay, here we go. Ron Taylor, very good. Senator Wilikowski, you persisted and we got a person online. Mr. Taylor.
Have that power, Mr. Chair.
Attaboy. Attaboy. Mr. Taylor, welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record, please, and tell us why you want to serve on the Alaska Police Standards Council.
My name is Ronald Taylor. I am the current Division Director for Probation and Parole. I'm in the Anchorage community, and I believe that it's extremely important to represent the correctional side of the Police Standards Council, and I'm more than eager to serve on the Alaska Police Standards Council.
This would be your first appointment to the council, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
That's correct, sir.
And have you attended any meetings of the Police Standards Council since you were nominated?
No, sir, I have not.
Have you attended meetings in the past?
No, sir, I have not.
And what do you know about what the Police Standards Council does?
Well, Mr. Chair, part of the role of the Police Standards Council is to ensure that there is consistency throughout the law enforcement community and that standards are being applied equally. And they also will hear those cases that will come up for review in terms of certification to determine whether or not it's appropriate for the person to maintain that certification.
And I'll just say that I've known Mr. Taylor for well over a decade. Before I got into politics, I knew him when I was a DA, and he was working at the ASAP program, and so I'm kind of biased in his favor because I know him, and I think he's entirely the right kind of person you want to have in one of these positions. But I'd be happy to have other members ask him questions. Mr. Taylor, you've stunned the committee into silence, which is great. Senator Wilikowski.
Mr. I'll just say, because I know we have a lot of people maybe watching online, many of these people have been before us before, and we know Mr. Taylor. He's done a fantastic job, I think, in many of the committee's opinions, as of many of the other people before us. So I don't want the public to think that we're not exercising due diligence. It's just we've seen these people over many years, and they've done a good job, and they're up for reappointment, and so that I think is what's leading to the just lack of questioning.
No, I think it's a fair point. It sounds. People on the Police Standards Council, like on many of those councils, are going to be asked to exercise their judgment about questions that come before them. And if you know a person and you trust their judgment, at some level you don't say, are you going to fine for this side or that side. You trust the individual to make a fair decision. Senator Passman.
Yeah, I follow up on Senator Wilikowski's comment, and with Mr. Taylor, just looking through the packet of information, that's a 7-page resume that his experience is most impressive, and so again, I look at that experience, and it speaks volumes for me. So,
That's a good addition to the record. Further questions? Don't see any. Thanks so much, Mr. Taylor, for making yourself available today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We do have Robert Sheldon on the line. Mr. Sheldon, are you there?
If you need Sheldon Smith, then I am here.
I beg your pardon. We've got two Sheldons today. So Sheldon Schmidt, put yourself on the record and tell us why you're interested in serving on the Alaska Police Standards Council.
For the confusion there, my name's Sheldon Schmidt. I'm currently the police chief over in Sitka, where I've been police chief for the past 6 years, 7 years, and I've got about over 15 years of experience in the state, a lot of it out in the bush. This is not my initial appointment. I guess you'd call it a reappointment.
Okay.
I was originally appointed in 2008, I believe. I'm not sure on the date on that. Since that time, I've been the vice chair, and recently I was elected as the chair of Alaska Police Standards Council. I'm definitely interested in continuing to serve on the Alaska Police Standards Council. I believe in their mission. I've been attended their meetings for years, the public meetings, and recently, of course, their full meetings, the private meetings, and the public meetings. So I appreciate your consideration for reappointment.
Mr. Schmidt, you are correct. You were appointed first in 2008. This would be a reappointment for 4 more years. Like the last candidate, you have a strong resume. I'll point out for the public that Mr. Schmidt has a Bachelor of Science degree with a criminal justice major, graduated magna cum laude from Minnesota State University, went on to get a master's from the University of Alaska Fairbanks in criminal justice, 12 years in law enforcement, currently the police chief in Sitka. Further questions for Mr. Schmidt? Don't hear or see any. Thanks so much for making yourself available, and we appreciate your willingness to continue serving.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. I think we're halfway through, and we've still got 3 more to go. Gus Sandahl. Mr. Sandahl, are you on the line?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record. Give us your name and tell us why you want to serve on the Alaska Police Standards Council.
My name is Gus Sandahl. I'm from Kenai, Alaska, and I'm the Kenai Police Chief. And I have been with the Kenai Police Department as an officer since 1995. I want to be on the Police Standards Council just to do my part. I think all the previous chiefs that I've worked for have been on the Alaska Police Standards Council at one time. And, I know Sheldon Schmidt. I know other members involved with the Alaska Police Standards Council. I have attended the public meetings for the last several years, and I did attend one of the meetings in this last December, I guess as a prospective member of the council. I feel I have a lot to contribute. I have almost 17 years of law enforcement experience. I have 10 years as a police supervisor. I've been a polygraph examiner since 2003, in which I've done criminal polygraph examinations and pre-employment polygraph examinations for all of the municipal departments on the Kenai Peninsula. And that role requires strong integrity, it requires diligence, it requires trust with the other departments and keeping information confidential. And in my police career, I've always tried to get involved with as much as I can without being completely overwhelmed. And this is just one other aspect of the job that I would like to be involved with, and I think I could contribute.
We thank you for doing so. I note that there are 4, the Police Standards Council has 13 members, 11 appointed by the governor, 4 of whom are police chiefs. I take it you're taking one of those police chief positions.
That is correct.
And I guess I don't know, when you're nominated to one of these positions, do you not serve on the board until you're confirmed by the legislature?
certainly you can serve on the board, and I was welcomed at that meeting, but I knew that once the Senate and House were in session that I would have to go through this confirmation. So right. I did participate in the meeting. I wasn't just a spectator.
Right. That was my understanding. I just hadn't really thought about it recently, that you know, the governor has put you on the council. We're just going to confirm you, but you're a fully functioning member of the council now.
That's what I gather as well.
Right. Okay, well, good. We're both in agreement. Further questions for Chief Sandahl. I don't see any. I see you were a commercial fisherman back in the day. You've been to a lot of academies, including the FBI National Academy, or at least you're a board member of the FBI National Academy as an associate board member. You've had sex assault response team training. You've had Crime Stoppers International training, whole host of criminal justice related trainings. I take it you're no longer a construction laborer. That was back in 95.
That's correct. In the very building that I am attending this teleconference at the Legislative Affairs Office, completely remodeled the upstairs.
Interesting. Great side note. I don't see any further questions. Chief, thanks so much for taking time out of your day, and we appreciate your service.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Next up is Robert Sheldon. And Mr. Sheldon is up for the Commission on Judicial Conduct. Mr. Sheldon, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And tell us about, put yourself on the record, give us your name and affiliation, if any, and why you're interested in serving on this important commission.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Robert Sheldon. I'm currently Vice Chair for the Alaska Commission on Judicial Conduct. It's been 4 years since I've last appeared before folks, and I know the group there has changed quite a bit, so thought I'd begin with a refresher on my own background. I'm a third-generation Alaskan who comes from two family lines of business folks who have been fortunate enough to have enough success to also volunteer for various civil services-related efforts. Each of my family lines has contributed in these ways to Alaska since the 30s. In 1993, I obtained a bachelor's degree in finance and a minor in economics. With it, I began work at First National Bank in their trust department and then co-founded a money management firm, Arbor Capital Management, in 1996. Since then, I've also been a volunteer in business community, facilitating, financing, and encouraging relationships. Most recently, my volunteer efforts have expanded via my appointment to the ADA and Alaska Energy Authority boards. I'd like to explain a little bit how my broad interest in finance and economics extends into understanding and interconnections with the judiciary. I'm fond of saying, and well, stating, that Alaska is an emerging economy saddled with a mature bureaucracy. This simple statement summarizes a tremendous challenge. On the one hand, an emerging economy needs to be flexible enough to develop all four sectors of an economy, which are resource extraction, value adds, services, and finally research and development, and to do so on a timetable that maximizes the use of available capital. On the other hand, frameworks found in a mature bureaucracy can be crucial to ensure that all participants have their say, and if there is a significant disagreement, that there is recourse. So this is a peculiar tension that Alaska exists under. We are just now progressing to the latter three areas of the economy that I mentioned, but doing so with the world's most advanced frameworks that are really meant for a mature economy. This brings us back to the reason why I'm before you today. The Alaska Commission on Judicial Conduct addresses the problems of judicial conduct and disability. In short, the commission stands for the most important attribute of our advanced bureaucratic framework, and that's the rule of law. Without rule of law, I believe it's fair to say we really have nothing. And for example, without it, companies are less likely to become interested in operating in such a jurisdiction. And this is the primary reason, for example, that many emerging economies exhibit corporate valuations that can be significantly lower than in economies where there is rule of law. People in many emerging economies generally do not know if their ownership can be perfected or a significant period of time, or if corruption would drain their profits away. And so by serving as a public member for the last Commission on Judicial Conduct, I'm doing my part to ensure that the best part of a mature bureaucracy continues, namely that the rule of law includes recourse for anyone should they believe that a judge has exhibited impaired conduct or disability.
Mr. Sheldon, thank you. It sounds like you take a very thoughtful approach to the job. You're one of the public members appointed by the governor, but with no essentially there's no connection between you and the legal world.
there's no direct connection between myself and the legal world.
Right. The statute tells us that there shall be three public members who are not judges, retired judges, or members of the state bar, and you would be one of those members.
That'd be correct, yes.
Further questions for Mr. Sheldon? I don't see any. This is a very important commission. I mean, I think you've captured that in your statements. You oversee the behavior of judges who stand for election only infrequently, and so the actions that the commission takes can be extremely important and extremely powerful. They can have a powerful effect on the career of a judge.
Mr. Chair, I definitely agree with that. We have an annual report where folks can find the numbers of items that come before us, and thankfully most of them are non-jurisdictional, meaning that they belong in another venue, perhaps the court system, for example, if it's a question of law. However, for those areas that involve courtroom behavior, improper or illegal influence, impropriety off the bench, as well as issues of physical or mental disability, those are the ones that we see. And fortunately, there's a venue for those items to be presented, and that's why I'm pleased to serve on it.
You bet. There has to be that venue, and again, it's extremely important that the public know that this behavior gets looked at by an impartial body. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you believe there should be any discussion about how we select judges, and do you think we're selecting them appropriately?
The methods in which judges are selected right now really isn't our bailiwick. And as I said 4 years ago when the committee was first considering confirming my name, I believe is the right term, I answered a similar question, and that was that decisions are made for good reason at the time that they're made, and it's up to us as someone, as an observer of those decisions, and to enforce those decisions. And currently, Alaska is one of several states in the camp that we fall in. Unfortunately, about every 2 years, the commission has attendees attend effectively judicial conduct conference where we get to see lots of different states and how, I believe there's about 42 of them, and how their process works, whether judges are voted for in the whole election process or the appointment process. And I just have to say, I think it's been very thoughtful how Alaska has been structured. And I am not one person to say whether it's right or wrong. I think it works. And so I don't really have an opinion whether or not the current process is right or wrong. I believe it works, however.
Well, Mr. Sheldon, again, we thank you for coming out today and appreciate your service.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Last up is Brad Reich. Brad Reich, did we get him on the line? Not there. We do have more confirmations coming next week. We will take up Mr. Reich's name at that time. I'm going to scratch his name off and see if the Vice Chair will make a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that in accordance with AS 3905080, the Judiciary Committee has reviewed the following and recommends appointments be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. And the names that are listed on this list are Mr. Sandel, Mr. Schmidt, Mr. Taylor, Ms. Chenault, Mr. Sheldon, and Mr. Stark.
Is there objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, those names will be forwarded. Let's take a brief at ease to get the paperwork done.
Back on the record. We're back on the record, and we've got several bills to take up. Let's turn to HB 80. And Senator Lukowski would like to hear from the Department of Law. So let's have them come up. We do have the bill sponsor here, but we got a good statement from you at the end of the last hearing. But Ms. Carpenter, if you can come up and answer a question. It's like a pop quiz in the criminal law.
Hi, my name is Annie Carpenetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Annie, for coming. We heard some testimony last week from Mr. Fayette, and I'm curious if that has changed the department's position on this bill at all.
Through the chair, it's my understanding that the administration of the state of Alaska supports House Bill 80.
So I take it the Department of Law does not have concerns, does not share the concerns that were raised by Mr. Fayette.
Through the chair, we support the bill. Individual people may feel differently about it, but as a department, we support House Bill 80.
Okay, and you've assessed the concerns raised by Mr. Fayette, and considering all that, you continue to support the bill?
The department continues to support the bill,
okay.
Yes.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Further questions? If not, I'd solicit a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move House Bill 80 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection? I'll say that I'm not going to object to the bill moving. I have not been a huge fan of this bill, but I have promised in writing and in person that I would let this bill go through the process. I'm honoring that pledge today. And so unless there's further objection, the bill is moved. Let's take a brief adieu for the paperwork. Back on the record, and we're going to take up SB 7, which has been in the committee for a year. We heard the bill about a year ago. We have the bill sponsor here. It's a bill we've been through pretty carefully. It hasn't changed since we last heard it, but it has been in the committee for a year. And is there committee discussion about the bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
I'm not going to say no to the bill at this point. The same reservations I had a year ago are still there. I don't know how to amend it to get to my satisfaction, so I won't stop it from going, but I just wanted to express I still have reservations on the bill. I just don't know what to do about it right now.
And Senator, I share, I know I worked through my mind trying to separate it out between this crime and that crime, and it just gets too cumbersome. It's too much to ask the Department of Corrections to watch out for and the Division of Elections to watch out for. I'm personally not sure where I am in the bill, but we've sort of worked on it as long as we can work on it, and it seems unfair just to bottle it up in committee. So unless there's further discussion, that's the list of motion on this bill. Senator Lukowski.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move Senate Bill number 7 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved, and bill file will come around to you for your signature a little bit later, but it's not in our position right at the moment. Thank you, Mr. Obermeyer. Now we will slow down. We'll go back on the record. To the extent that anyone thought that was going off the record, we're back on the record. And
Who's on?
There's no reason to think that I wasn't going off the record. We are back on the record. And we are going to slow down now because we've got a major piece of legislation in front of us. CS for Senate Bill number 110, the backslash that I have is backslash M for Montana. If we can get a motion to accept that CS.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilkowski has moved the CS before us. Is there objection?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Do I need to object to get the whole version update, or do I wait?
You know, it's interesting how different chairmen handle that. And my view is that we're just trying to get the CS in front of us so we can talk about it. And so you are not in danger of this being moved in a hurry.
Let's okay, well then, I won't object. I just want to
actually,
get this.
Actually, it should be X. I will move that we bring version X in front of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just got a note from my staff that it was X. I would move that we bring CS for Senate Bill number 110, version X, in front of us.
The motion is to adopt X. Hearing and seeing no objection, the CS is before us. We haven't talked about moving it. It's just here in front of us. And now we're going to make sure we stop and take a few minutes to understand it. If we could have Ms. Carpinetti and your staffer come forward, Senator Wilkowski, to walk us through the bill. If you'd put yourselves on the record.
Go ahead. For the record, Kendra Kloster, staff to Senator Wilkowski.
Annie Carpinetti, representative of the Criminal Division of the Department of Law.
This is a somewhat lengthy bill, so why don't we just go ahead and start at the beginning and work our way through it so we know what we're doing. Which one of you wants to volunteer for that?
Ms.
Kloster, go ahead.
Why don't you go ahead.
All right. So as you see, the version in front of you, version X, is kind of a mashup of Senate Bill 110 and Senate Bill 218.
Maybe the first time the word mashup was used on the record. And so I just want to stop and say thank you.
I think that's an appropriate adjective.
Yes, there are a number of changes, so I'll start here with sections. I just want to 1, 2, 11 through 15, 17, 20, and through 29, just for stating most of these are conforming amendments, which is changing prohibiting prostitution to sex trafficking, and this was part of Senate Bill 218. And some of the sections that I'll go through, starting with Section 3, this is part of 218 as well, adds the crime of human trafficking in the first degree and sex trafficking in the first degree to felonies described under most serious felony offenses. And
Ms. Carpenter, remind me, for serious felony offense, we give a list of definitions, but in essence, what does it really mean?
These crimes described as a serious felony offense apply to the conspiracy law of our state. These are the crimes that are
you
subject
can charge
to a prosecution for conspiracy.
Thank you. That's what that does. Excellent. Keep going.
Okay. Sections 4 through 8, this is part of Senate Bill 110. And for this part, what our intention here was that we're doing is Section 4 is going to be an unclassified felony for human trafficking in the first degree. This is for persons under the age of 18. We get into Section 5, and this is for the individuals who are over the age of 18. And one of the things that we did in this statute as well is remove come to the state. This takes care of the issue of what we originally had was trafficking that was happening just over state lines, and we were trying to correct the issue of trafficking that was happening within the state.
Let's stop for a minute there, because this is a section that we really thought a lot about.
Yes.
And Senator Wilkowski and I spent a lot of time thinking about this. I know other members of the committee have, and we really struggled with the idea of movement. And we just sort of finally decided that if you're committing this crime, you can commit it to one of your neighbors, you can commit it to someone from Bethel, you can commit it, you know, that the idea of geography doesn't really play in here as strongly as the act of more or less forcing someone into engaging in sexual conduct, adult entertainment, or labor by force or threat of force. and or by deception. And so, and as we, the more we rolled this around in our mind and tried to think up some way to define that movement, the weaker it got, the more confusing it got. And that was our thought process, was it just collapsed on itself. And we finally decided, if you compel someone to come across the street to engage in sexual conduct, that's trafficking. And so at least that was my thinking. I think that was the thinking shared by the bill sponsor.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Cockhill.
So would that fall into what was in Section 3 because of kidnapping? I'm just curious. Some of the questions that were raised under Section 5 about movement within the state, would there still be some application in Section third section under 1131.0120?
Through the chair, Senator Cockhill, the bill provides that human trafficking in the first degree, which is the unclassified felony, would be subject to conspiracy prosecution.
Conspiracy, okay.
And it would depend on the facts whether it was also would also be a kidnapping offense too.
All right.
But kidnapping is also, I think, an offense under the conspiracy.
And Mr. Chairman, that was my concern, that somebody being lured out of a village under false pretenses. I didn't want that to be totally left off. I'm wondering out loud if this is kind of covered under that.
That was certainly our intention, Ms. Carpinetti. If someone's lured out of a village to engage in sexual conduct by force, threat of force, or deception, would that be covered by Section 5?
Through the chair, yes, it would. But, at this point, the bill doesn't require, as an element of the offense, that there was any movement of the person from a village to, for example, Anchorage. But it does require the other elements of the offense, that you compel or induce another person to engage in this conduct by use of force, threat of force, or deception.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Senator Pascal.
Just as a clarification, conspiracy takes two or more. So if someone is all by themselves inducing or coercing someone, is it still a violation of human trafficking?
Through the chair, it would be it could be a violation of human trafficking, but it would not be a conspiracy.
Right.
Because conspiracy requires two or more people agreeing and one person acting.
Wanted to make sure it's being written not to create an exception if one is doing it by themselves.
Right. Well, I think Section 3, if I can just jump in, I think the confusion is Section 3 just says these offenses can be conspiracy. Because in this state, you can't commit conspiracy to commit, say, DWI. Because it's just not one of these offenses that can ever be a conspiracy crime.
Right. Our state has always been very cautious about conspiracy law, and if you look at these crimes, you'll notice that they're very serious offenses that can be subject to a conspiracy.
Right. I'm tracking. I just want to make sure it's clear on the record.
So. I appreciate that. I really do. It's worth it just to take a minute, articulate it, and that way you've got a good, strong statement in case we start to go awry. These are important matters, and we've got plenty of time to make sure we do it right. So we're through Section 5, Section 6.
Okay, so Section 6 is part of the original Senate Bill 110, where we are taking human trafficking in the second degree as a Class A felony. And Section 7 is... same thing with Senate Bill 110, human trafficking in the third degree. And Section 8 is defining adult entertainment and sexual conduct.
Okay.
As we move on to Section 9, if we're ready, this
yes.
is back to what was originally in Senate Bill 218. And... this one raises the penalty for the patron of prostitution and moves it from a Class B misdemeanor to a Class C felony. In this section, Section 10, actually, we are also adding an affirmative defense in here as well, which was actually a change from the original legislation.
Could I just supplement that answer?
Ms. Carpinetti.
It raises the penalty for being a patron of a prostitute under certain circumstances. First, that the prostitute is under 18 years of age. The patron is 18 years of age or older plus 3 years older than the prostitute. And under those circumstances, it would be a Class C felony. Otherwise, it would still be a Class B misdemeanor. And there is the affirmative defense applies reasonable mistake of age if the defendant took reasonable steps to verify the age of the prostitute.
And just for the record, while we're here and thinking about this, maybe the department, Ms. Carpenter, you can articulate why if the prostitute, under this, under Section 10, if the prostitute's 17, the patron has to be 21, and then it's a C felony. If the patron's 19, it's a, did I do my math right, 17, 18, yeah, 19, 20, no, if the prostitute's 17, the patron has to be 20. Then it's a C felony. If the prostitute's 17 and the patron's 18, it's a B misdemeanor. What's the just someone's going to challenge this law? Give us the reason why we decided to make
the
this.
Reason is the same reason that we have the age differentials in our sexual abuse of a minor statute, and that is because especially at that age, when you're in your teens, you are much more influenced by an older person, so that. The Alaska legislature made the decision that it wouldn't be a serious crime for a 16-year-old or a 15-year-old to have sex with a 13-year-old, but it is more serious for an 18-year-old under those circumstances because of the power that an older person has over a younger person and the influence that power has in inducing a younger person to engage in certain conduct.
Thank you, Ms. Senator Coghill.
In my understanding, is this the first time that we have entered into charging patrons?
That's an interesting question through the chair. It wasn't a crime to be a patron of a prostitution till 2007 when this committee passed, I believe it was House Bill 90, which incorporated some other bills. One was Senator Dyson's bill that made it a crime to be a patron of a prostitute for the first time in our state history. And that was very significant, I think. It was in 1978 when the criminal code was adopted. Our office argued to the code commissioners that it ought to be a crime to be a patron, as it is to be a prostitute. And we finally made, everybody did a good job in 2007, I think, in finally making that change. And this goes further and makes it even better because that age range is a big difference for a young person. To be victimized.
Thanks for the refresher, of course.
Thank you, Senator Cotkill. Good question. Section 11.
Section 11 here is part of the conforming of changing the promoting prostitution language to sex trafficking.
Excellent.
And the same goes for Section 12.
Okay.
And 13.
Just a name change, yep.
Section 14, also conforming a name change from promoting prostitution to sex trafficking. And
okay.
Section 15 is doing the same.
Okay.
Section 16 does something a little bit different. So this is, under current law, no corroboration is required of testimony for an alleged victim in promoting prostitution, or sex trafficking as we're calling it now. So this bill adds the crime of sex trafficking in the fourth degree to those crimes. They're not required to have corroboration of testimony.
You just added one statute. Current law goes from 110 to 130. We're now going from 110 to 135. Right?
Correct.
I'm on page 7, line 8.
Correct.
Okay, keep going.
Section 17, conforming as well, changing promoting prostitution to sex trafficking, and we're also here adding human trafficking in this language as well.
Okay.
Section 18, this one actually corrects an error. This bill adds the offense of another offense described in unclassified felonies in Alaska law. This one was originally in 218 as well. More comments from Annie?
We're just adding.
This is a general classification provision in Title 18 which describes our crimes in the various categories that they fall into. I am just thinking that we ought to be adding human trafficking in the first degree also to Section 18, because that is also an unclassified felony if under this bill. When I saw it, I didn't see human trafficking in the first degree under 1141.355.
1141.355?
Yes.
Do we need a subsection?
No.
Okay. Let's just stop for a moment and I will propose an amendment, conceptual amendment, to page 8, line 24, following the comma after the sub 2, adding the words human trafficking in the first degree.
Actually, you probably don't even need a section number because these other statutes don't refer to a section number.
Okay.
I think the reason sex trafficking does is under that section it's an unclassified, but under A1 it is just a class A.
There's no way to be confused about
yeah.
it. Okay. We'll take your advice, and so my amendment would be to add the words human trafficking in the first degree following the sub 2 on page 8, line 24. That's amendment number 1, conceptual amendment number 1. I'm going to move the amendment. Is there objection?
Mr. Chair, is it wise to state exactly where we want it? I wonder if the drafter might want it somewhere else. I think if we just add it.
Oh, I'm not going to tolerate that. sure. I think obviously it goes in this section 18. I'm going to suggest it goes on line 24. If the drafter feels strongly about it, we're open for reasonable accommodations. Welcome to the end of the session. That's the amendment as modified by Senator Wilkowski.
And Mr. Chairman, it doesn't have to reference the 1141.355?
Not according to Ms. Carpinetti.
Okay.
We'll put that conceptual amendment on the books, and I'll move it. Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, we'll take a very, very close look at that when it comes back from the drafters. But that's amendment number 1, and that brings us to section 19.
Okay, section 19 is adding sex trafficking in place of promoting prostitution, also adding human trafficking in the first degree under there as well. On to 20, another conforming amendment.
Very good.
Oh.
This just adds human trafficking to those crimes
right.
that do not qualify for an SIS.
Can't get an SIS.
Unlikely, but possible.
Mm-hmm. But make sure it doesn't happen. Section 21.
Conforming, also changing the words promoting prostitution to sex trafficking and adding human trafficking in the first degree.
And maybe just an explanation about line 22 and 23 on page 10. Why we add the modifiers sexual conduct or adult entertainment.
Would you like me to answer? Or would you
yes, please. Go ahead.
Ms. Carpinetti.
Section 21 deals with the provision in our sentencing law, subsection I under 1255-125, that deals with heightened sentencing ranges for certain serious sex offenses. And I believe the reason that it specifies sexual conduct or adult entertainment so as to not import into these higher ranges of labor, because human trafficking prohibits bringing, forcing people to undertake labor, which is really not a sex offense, and that's why it should not be in this section.
So a worker on a cruise ship or a worker in a fish plant, someone's been brought here to perform simple labor, it's wrong, it's still against the law, we've got a law on the books about it, but we can't call that a sex crime.
Yes, and it shouldn't be subject to the heightened sentencing ranges for serious sex offenses.
Very good. Further questions about that provision? Thank you for the explanation. That takes us to page 11 in the material on lines 22 and 24. Ms. Closter or Ms. Carpinetti?
I'm going to defer to Ms. Carpinetti.
I haven't read this yet, so if you could just give me a second to read this.
Take your time.
Mr. Chairman, this continues the previous section in adding human trafficking to the heightened ranges for sex offenses, and it does so by, in this provision, adding attempt, conspiracy, or solicitation to commit human trafficking in the second degree under the first degree offense for human trafficking only involving sexual conduct or adult entertainment, and so that it would not include labor.
Same idea. Very good.
Senator Codgett, for me, the conspiracy or solicitation becomes the key element on this?
Well, in this particular area of sentencing, if you are convicted of the target offense, human trafficking, mm-hmm. you would be subject to to higher ranges under previous sections. This paragraph 3, which starts on line 19 of page 11, deals with generally Class B misdemeanors and, Class B felonies. And it would be a sexual assault in the second degree is a B felony, attempt, conspiracy, or solicitation to commit human trafficking under 360, which is the target is an A felony. This the conspiracy or other solicitation are B felonies. This groups it within the other B felonies in the larger group of sex offenses, which are subject to a higher range under our law than regular old, you know, B felony theft or something like that.
Thank you.
Very good. That 22. Takes us to the next page.
22 now. Mm-hmm. This is also a conforming amendment which changes promoting prostitution to sex trafficking, but this also corrects an omission of online enticement of a minor, of adding that to the most serious felony.
Very good. Section 23.
Would you like
to? Yes, I'm just trying to remember which one this one was. Go ahead.
Okay. Through the chair, I'm happy to see this in the CS. This is the definitional section for serious felony, and it corrects some omissions that were made in the last several years when we changed our sentencing law. We didn't we failed to change the definition of sexual felony, which does come into play in our presumptive ranges for sex offense sentencing, so that online enticement of a minor ought to be there because it's included within the serious offenses subject to a heightened range in 1255, 125I, excuse me for using those numbers, but that's how I think about those heightened ranges for sex offenses, for serious sex offenses.
Very good. Section 24.
Section adds human trafficking and sex trafficking to the definition of sex offense.
Makes sense. Section 25.
This one is also changing the language promoting prostitution to sex trafficking and adding human trafficking.
Very good. Section 26.
Also conforming, changing promoting prostitution to sex trafficking and adding human trafficking in the first and second degree.
It might be helpful to the committee that this definition, this 2815046, applies to school bus drivers.
Oh.
Those offenses that you can't be a school bus driver if you're convicted of, and it adds these provisions.
I think you've got unanimous support for that idea.
Yep. Thank you.
Section 27.
And we're on 27. Page 16, we are changing promoting prostitution to the language of sex trafficking again and adding human trafficking in the first degree.
This is part of it, excuse me, this is part of the section dealing with when information about a delinquent minor can be is subject to being publicized.
Very good. Section 28.
28 is a similar conforming amendment dealing with agency records for juveniles when they are subject to being released to the public.
Section 29, we've got two repealers. Tell us about them.
Those are your sections. Would you like to know?
One was...
Need a statute book?
I think it's, we're going to have to go back to the
statute. It's always the negative. Yeah, you got to. That's okay.
I think these address human trafficking.
That was the human trafficking question.
Take a second, make sure. Yep.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Cockfield. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Wilkowski.
Just looking at the statute, this would repeal the definition. AS 1141-360-B1 is the definition of adult entertainment. In the current section, it describes it as conduct described in AS 2310-350-F1-3. And I think we've defined it elsewhere in this statute.
Adult entertainment.
And the other section, 360-B3, is the definition of sexual conduct, which it is described in the current statute as meaning the meaning given in AS 1166-150. And again, I believe that is defined elsewhere in this bill.
Adult entertainment is at Section 8 and sub... Sorry, what was B3?
Sexual conduct.
Oh, sexual conduct. Yeah, there it is. And also in Section 8, page 5, line 1. So there they are. They're in the bill. We're not repealing anything. We're not putting back in. Section 30.
Section 30 is the applicability section. It generally applies, makes applicable to crimes committed today, tomorrow, and yesterday, all of the conforming changes that were made to the name of the crime, which would be sex trafficking, and had, under current law, is promoting prostitution. Generally, new crimes like conspiracy, the new additions to the conspiracy law, the increase in the penalty for being a patron of a prostitute if the prostitute is younger and the defendant is older, all the new crimes, new criminal activities apply to acts committed the day this law becomes effective and crimes committed afterwards to avoid constitutional concerns with ex post facto laws.
Very good. Section 31.
Section 31 is an instruction to the reviser, which are put into laws sometimes. The reviser is pretty smart, does it themselves most of the time. But we are asking them to head the catch lines for certain crimes and the chapter titles for certain crimes to change from promoting prostitution to sex trafficking.
And Section 32?
An effective date of July 1st, 2012.
Assuming we get it through the House and the governor signs it. So we have been through the bill, committee discussion. My view, this is to a large extent a reviser's bill, changing the names of many crimes. The substantive sections are ones we've been over and been thinking about for some time. We did take a lot of what was in the governor's sex trafficking bill and put it in this one, frankly, just in my view, to preserve the place that Senator Wilkowski earned by filing his bill last year. And that was at my behest, urging, and direction. And so that's how we got this bill in front of us. We've been through it carefully. Committee discussion. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have been through this bill for over a year now. And I would move that we move CS for Senate Bill Number 110, Judiciary Version /X, as amended, with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection?
Mr. Chairman, only
Senator
only,
Cockhill.
Only to comment, you know, it's not an objection to the bill, but just so that I could at least thank the chairman, the administration for the work, the chairman sitting to my left here. The question of will this work for those moved within the state still lingers in my mind, and it's just a lingering thought. So, it looks like we not only ramped up the definitions but and the penalties significantly. So, it's just a lingering doubt. It's not an overall question, and certainly the way this will actually land in process is still a little bit of a mystery to me. So, I think the policy statement we're making here is good. I'm still working on understanding how this will actually hit the ground. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll remove my objection.
And I appreciate that. I would encourage you to chat with the Department of Law or come chat with me more about how this works. Frankly, last night during a correction subcommittee, we took a look at the prisoner counts, and we don't catch a lot of people under these laws. We don't put a lot of people in prison under these laws, but I think we all recognize, and it's fairly minuscule, really, but I think we all recognize that it's important to have those tools available, because if even one girl is brought from Bethel to Anchorage or from one side of Bethel to the other to engage in sex trafficking, that is wrong, wrong, wrong. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a comment. And the real reason I thought this would be a very simple one-paragraph bill change when we first started out, because what we were really trying to do was change the statute so that we didn't discriminate against Alaskans, and that we had a situation where you could bring a young girl, a woman from Seattle and ship her to Ketchikan, and that would be a serious felony. But if you did the same thing, shipping a woman or girl from a rural village in, Antioch, Bethel, Barrow to Anchorage or Fairbanks, it wouldn't be a similar crime under Alaska statutes, and so it may be under other statutes, but it wouldn't be the same type of trafficking crime. And so that was really where we started with this. We went around in a circle, and I think we've ultimately realized that this is a big problem. We heard testimony that there were 25 cases of women who got compensation from the Victims' Rights Compensation Board for in-state trafficking and unaware of any for the out-of-state trafficking. So it is a problem out there. We've heard from the APD, we've heard from Covenant House, we've heard from the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. This is a problem. This attempts to address that problem, and it's got a little ways to go, but I think we've put a lot of time into this, and I think it's a good policy call. And if there are tweaks to be made as we move along, I'm certainly open to working with the department or other committees as we move. Or Senator Cockell, if you have any changes.
There's a bill. There's a motion to move the bill. We've had committee discussion, hearing and seeing no objection to move the bill. The bill is moved. We'll take a short at ease.
Thank you.
We are back on the record, and let's take up CS for Senate Bill number 151. We have a new CS before us. Backslash is U for uniform. If we could get a motion to adopt that CS.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilikowski has moved the CS before us. Is there objection? Hearing seeing none, the CS is before us, and we have now the excellent staffer of Senator Myers, Ms. Marsegan. Welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record and tell us what the CS does.
For the record, my name is Christine Mirsey, and I'm the staffer to Senator Kevin Meyer. The new CS that's before you, the changes from version O to version U, which is the CS you have, makes two changes, both on page 3. The first change was section 18, deleting a line off of 13 and 14, and then section 20, deleting the last line 30 Those were the two main substantive changes to the bill. The first one, of course, keeps in with the intent of the bill of wanting to make sure that we are looking at more non-violent or lesser crimes for this to be applied as a mitigator. And the last section is to clear up any confusion as to who actually gets to diagnose FASD, since with other types of mental illnesses, we leave that up to the court as long as there's clear and convincing evidence that that does, in fact, exist.
Ms. Mayor Segan, thank you for that explanation. My staff and I were involved, of course, in the crafting of the CS, and it was our thinking, and I think it's the thinking of the sponsor. You can correct me if I'm wrong, that we wanted this to apply to nonviolent crimes, to crimes that were not committed against a person. We toyed with the idea of making it available only once, and then we ultimately decided that that was probably not productive. Mitigators really applied at felons who are committing another felony. That's really where they're the most powerful, where they do the most good, if you will. And so if you're going to make it available, you got to make it available for repeat felons. So we decided to make it focused only on not crimes that were not committed against a person. And we wrestled with how to sort of tell a judge who could make this decision, and we ultimately decided that given the presence of subsection 18 up on lines 12 through 16 about mental disease or defect, we don't tell the judge how to decide that one. So why tell a judge how to decide fetal alcohol spectrum disorder? We had a lot of great testimony in a previous hearing about who makes this decision, how much work goes into it, and we expect that's the kind of evidence that a judge would look to, but it just seemed unnecessary for us to put a cookbook instruction about a sort of a complicated medical diagnosis into a statute. Further questions? I appreciate the work that a sponsor and the willingness of the sponsor to have this massaged a little bit in committee. And
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Coghill,
just for what it's worth, I appreciate your work and the sponsor's work on this. You know, not only not telling the judge what the cookbook is, but I think to me, as we asked questions, we found out that the resources in Alaska are much more available than I had previously thought. So I think the judges do have a lot to draw on that I was not aware of. So I think we probably brought that out.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Further questions? Don't see any. With that, I would solicit a motion. Senator Wilkowski.
Chair, I would move that we move CS for Senate Bill number 151, version /U, out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved. Thank you, Ms. Marcy. Thanks for
Thank
being
you,
here.
Chairman.
Say hi to Senator Meyer. Let's turn now to SB 198. That is Senator Wilkowski's bill, and we've got folks here to testify about it, and I don't want to miss that opportunity. So we're going to set one of my bills aside and one of Senator McGuire's bill aside and try to get to that at the next hearing. But we do have Senator Wilkowski. I'll turn to you, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We introduced this bill last week, or a few days ago. It seems like a week ago. It's essentially a bill that would provide some protections for police officers, and it's some basic due process rights when they're having their certificates potentially revoked. It would require a standard of clear and convincing evidence, which is a standard that is used in some other professions. Some you do use preponderance of the evidence, but this is sort of like in employment law. They call this the death penalty. If you get your certificate revoked, you cannot be a police officer, probably in any other place in the United States. So it's a very serious thing that could happen to a police officer, and essentially assuring that they have some basic due process rights. We also have a provision that the revocation be done according to the Administrative Procedure Act, which I think is currently being done, but we're just codifying that, putting it in statute. We're also saying that we're going to allow the Police Standards Council to suspend certificates, which is giving them another tool, another option in case in the situation where revocation may not be warranted, but they want to have some sort of punishment they will allow them to suspend. Also, there are concerns about police officers with confidentiality, and this would allow police officers to have confidentiality regarding their personal information. And then there's some protections we're adding for polygraph tests. And there's an interesting packet that we've provided for you on the United States Supreme Court decision on the unreliability of polygraph tests, which happy to go over more with you, Mr. Chair. But we've got a lot of witnesses signed up, and it's I'm short on time, and I would urge that we get to as many witnesses as we can.
Senator Wilkowski, I appreciate that. Questions for the bill sponsor? I don't see any. We do have several witnesses lined up. We've got about 15 minutes left. Let's get started on that. Let's start with Dave Sexton from Juneau. Mr. Sexton, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Dave Sexton. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Police Standards Council. You met some of my board members earlier this meeting when the reconfirmation hearing. I'd like to first of all reintroduce you to the work of the council, what they do. The mission of the Alaska Police Standards Council is to produce and maintain highly trained and positively motivated professional officers capable of meeting contemporary law enforcement standards of performance. The core services we provide the state of Alaska. In cases of misconduct by a certified police officer, we make a determination whether certification should be revoked. We monitor compliance with current regulations and legislation. We develop, monitor, and revise law enforcement training. We assist academies and departments with funding for academy training. We fund specialized and advanced training for departments. We determine certification eligibility for all police, probation, and correctional officers and issues appropriate levels of certificate. And finally, we provide pre-employment polygraph and psychological testing for smaller agencies across the state. Senate Bill 198 directly affects, or more honestly cuts, to the heart of several of our core services. Please keep our ability to provide these services to the people of Alaska in mind as you contemplate this proposed bill. Let's talk first about certification. In this state, as in most states, you need to earn a certificate in order to possess and wield police powers. Our process certifies that you have the education, the training, and moral fiber to do the job as legislation has seen fit to define it. At any one time, we have about 3,000 sworn officers in this state. This bill wants to inhibit and intervene with our ability to, if necessary, decertify an officer. While we consider the ability to decertify an errant officer critical to our mission and goals, revoking a certificate is but a scalpel in our tool belt. I'm assuming that the changes this bill proposes are actions taken in response to a perceived current problem. I'm not sure what this problem is, however. In the past 5 years, only 6 officers have lost their certificate due to council revocation. Let me repeat that. 3,000 sworn officers in the state. 6 of them had their certificates taken away of them by council action over a 5-year period. These certificates were revoked after charges of sexual assault of a minor, sexual assault, harassment, official misconduct, and dishonesty were leveled. In our world, possible misconduct is reported to Alaska Police Standards Council staff, which fully investigates the matter, and only if we find it appropriate is the matter given to full council, which again reviews all of the facts before taking action. Council action can be further appealed through the court system, if the officer so desires. As you heard earlier, the council is made up of 13 members, handpicked by the governor and affirmed by the legislature. They are police and correctional management, line officers and union members, and citizens at large. You could not ask for a more balanced, knowledgeable, trustworthy board whose primary mission is the protection of the citizens of Alaska. Clearly, this bill is a solution in search of a problem. Our legal counsel from the Department of Law wishes to speak to 2 proposed changes that are necessary to give substantial weight to prior decisions in our deliberations, and the changing of the burden of proof for our investigations from the preponderance of evidence to clear and convincing evidence. I have no doubt he will express himself more eloquently than I concerning these legal matters. Suffice it to say, the council has grave concerns to be singled out and held to different standards than the four dozen other boards and commissions required to uniformly operate under the requirements of the State Administrative Procedures Act. Our next concern revolves around the use of polygraphs and other truth verification devices. We appreciate the work done on an earlier version of this bill and the cooperation that resulted in not prohibiting pre-employment polygraphs. Right now, both Alaska and federal labor law recognizes the special relationship and trust between the citizens and their law enforcement officers and allows the use of polygraphs in both pre-employment and investigative situations. The council is asking, if it's a good idea to take a polygraph to get a job, what changes that you can't take a polygraph to keep a job? It takes a lot to earn police powers. Not everyone is up to the challenge. We request the bar not be lowered and the standards held to be employed remain the same to stay employed. In fact, 9 out of 10 states allow for investigative polygraph use in matters concerning law enforcement officers' behaviors. We will find ourselves way outside the norm should we become one of the 1 in 10 recognizing this exception. As not a single recent council revocation action hinged on polygraph results, council is again at a loss why this section of the bill is being introduced. Next, this bill demands the department cease supplying photographs of our officers in actions and in the performance of their duties. The language in this bill goes against every tenet of community policing we have tried to put in place for the last 2 decades. If adopted, I can no longer show pictures of my officers receiving a check from the local Rotary to go to Special Olympics, and I can no longer hang the photos of my officers in the lobby of my police department or City Hall. I want my community to know who my officers are. That is how you build community support, trust, and cooperation. These images are important to recruitment. Alaska Statute 3925080 already makes it unlawful to disseminate state personnel records information, including home addresses. Obviously, we have no objection to following current state law. We do object to giving away management rights to run progressive, modern, community-oriented departments. Finally, it would mean a great deal to the council if we could discuss changes to the definition of police officer, which you will find under Section 4 of this bill. It has been a long-time goal of the council to remove the words full-time from the definition of police officer. Removing these two words not only bring part-time, seasonal, and reserve officers under our oversight, but protects cities and jurisdictions who are trying to do the right thing by hiring on additional help, only to find their employees are operating outside of the regulations. As proposed today, the Alaska Police Standards Council opposes much of this bill. As stated before, however, we appreciate all the work that has gone into making this bill more meaningful, and we look forward to the same cooperative working spirit with this committee as we enjoyed with the last. Thank you for the opportunity to present the council's views. I'm at your service for any questions.
Mr. Sexton, thank you. Just one quick point, and then I want to get to Mr. Skidmore, who's waiting to testify. You mentioned that it would be illegal to hang the picture of a police officer in City Hall. Do you, and I'm looking at page 3, lines 28 and 29, do you think the police officer would object to your hanging a picture of him or her in City Hall and would not authorize that picture to be hung?
That's what we're saying, yes, sir. If he doesn't give his okay to hang that picture, we would have a display of all of our officers missing the 3 or 4 or 5 that may not want it there. So it's not a complete picture.
Right. But do you really think that a police officer would object to that?
That's what – I don't know why this is in here then. You know, I mean, that's why we I don't know. Maybe why else is it in here?
Senator Willekowski.
Do you have any objection to keeping the home address confidential?
No problem at all. We believe the home address confidential is already covered, and we have, if you want to restate that in this bill, we have no objection to home address.
Fair enough. Thank you so much. Mr. Skidmore, John Skidmore. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you for your patience.
You have a lot of important work today. I'm happy
this
to
is,
wait.
And this is one of the important things we have to do, and you're an important person, so thanks for being here.
For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the director of the Criminal Division for the Department of Law here in the state of Alaska. I've worked as a prosecutor in the state for the last 16 years. Over those years, I've had the opportunity to work in a number of communities all across the state, Dillingham, Bethel, Kenai, Anchorage. More recently, before I took my position as the director of the Criminal Division, I was the head of a unit called Special Prosecutions. In that capacity, what I primarily was responsible for was special cases or conflict cases. That includes those that dealt with peace officers. My office and I specifically reviewed every case in the state that involved an officer-involved fatality, many of the officer-involved shooting cases. Prior to taking that position, I handled the prosecution of a gentleman by the name of Sam Cohen, a former APD officer who had sexually abused his daughter. So I have some background in dealing with those sorts of cases. Beyond that, now as the director of the Criminal Division, I now provide legal advice to the Alaska Police Standards Council. Let me begin by saying I think that there are many things in the bill that are very good, and I'm pleased to see that it's there. I think the ability to suspend officers' certifications in addition to just revoking them is an excellent addition to the tool belt that's provided to the Alaska Police Standards Council. I think that the reinforcement, if you will, of the confidentiality of officers' information, I don't have any objections to. I take note of the question from Chairman of whether or not an officer would object to having their picture posted in City Hall. I quite frankly agree with you. I think that it's unlikely that officers would object to that sort of thing. When I first looked at it, I had concerns that it would prohibit us from being able to distribute photographs of officers that had been charged. Then I saw the next subsection clearly eliminates that concern of mine. So I don't have a problem with confidentiality. I do agree with Mr. Sexton. I think that it's already found in law that those things are confidential, but I have absolutely no qualms with this body or with the legislature as a whole reinforcing those confidentiality requirements for law enforcement officers. That's extremely important in this day and age. I know I myself have concerns about my address being listed out there, and we all know how easy it is to find such things in Google. The last thing we want to do is make it available in a public records request as well. So I think there are many good provisions for the bill in that regard. There are two that I would like to address and that I'd ask for your consideration on. The first is Section 3. Section 3 essentially says that the legislature would bind the Alaska Police Standards Council. That is, if there is some employment action taken with an officer, the council really shouldn't be doing anything much different than what happened in that employment action. I can appreciate why some may want to see that there. If I may, let me pose to you, gentlemen, why that may not be a good idea. The Alaska Police Standards Council is a council that has statewide jurisdiction. The idea is that we want to set a minimum for officers all across the state to meet in their qualifications, both when they initially become officers and after they are officers, for their continuing conduct. We want that to be consistent. If you instead say that the council must give this substantial weight or significant weight to individual departments' litigation, then what you're really saying is we now have to give substantial consideration to all the different lawyers that might be involved for all the different agencies all across the state, the different levels of representation that individual officers might have, and individual court decisions. All of those decisions have so many other factors that go into it. Why would you want to bind the council made up of those 13 good people? You heard most of them here today. You heard some of them here today. Ron Taylor, and I heard each one of you say very commendable things about those people on the council. And what I would submit to you all is that the council is made up of good, solid citizens who are members of the law enforcement community or have had connections to it. You want to know who one of the citizen members of the council is right now? Dick Burton, the former commissioner for the Department of Public Safety, the person who was probably around when the council was originally created. Those are the types of people that are on the council. And what you're saying is you want to bind their decision-making about who is a good quality officer and bind them to ensure that there's consistency all across the state to what's happening with the employment. And that's what I think would not be such a good idea. You have a question next to you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilkerson.
Thank you. And I'll just tell you where this stemmed from, and maybe there, we tweaked the language in the last committee. Maybe there's some further tweaking that needs to be done. But We're trying to avoid the situation where someone an officer is the subject of, let's say, a termination case, goes up, sure. An arbitrator finds in his favor or her favor, case is appealed, that court finds in his or her favor, the Supreme Court affirms the decision.
Right.
Shouldn't that be given some sort of weight in when the council makes its decision on whether to revoke a license?
I don't disagree that it should be given some weight, and I recognize the changes that were made between when it was first done and where it's at now, and I appreciate that. I think that those are good changes. When you still call, and forgive me, I don't have it in front of me at the moment, but it's the substantial weight or the wording that's there.
Shall give substantial weight.
Substantial weight. Yeah. If your intent is that you simply want the council to pay attention to the fact that those things have occurred, you want them to consider those things, I don't think that's a problem. Where I run into the issue, though, is what does substantial weight mean? I don't know what the legislative intent would be in those circumstances. And I recognize the scenario that you describe. And what I would tell you is, as I was saying a moment ago, when you have those individual litigations, you're requiring the council to depend upon the notion that in that litigation, the counsel that was representing the police department set forth all the appropriate facts, got all the appropriate rulings, and that things went exactly as they should in that process. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. I don't think the council should be bound by what happened there. Do you want them to consider it? Fine. That's not a problem. But if you say that the council's decision has to mirror what happened there, again, you're asking for substantial weight to be given to all of these myriad of factors, which really infringes or interferes with the ability to have that consistency across the state, which is why you have one council addressing the minimum standard for all the officers in the state. And that seems like the appropriate public policy decision, which is where my comments are based on. So I understand your concerns. I just don't know what that legislative intent is. And without knowing that, as a lawyer, I always get worried when I'm not sure what the legislative intent is.
Well, we're establishing legislative intent right now.
Senator Bassman.
You know, I can take what you're saying and say, you know, you use the words bind and bound, and I see nothing in here in my mind that says that it is going to be compulsory binding or will bound the council. To the contrary, what I look at here is that they would look at this appellate procedure or administrative hearing officer's decision, and they would have to explain why it was being followed or not being followed. In other words, I just think that that is not an unacceptable burden, that if it is a supportable determination that the council makes, that they rationalize that in light of, for example, an Alaska Supreme Court decision. And so, in other words, I don't follow your use of the words bind at all. I just see that it says that if there's a Supreme Court opinion, the council better explain itself as to why that is or is not significant.
And if that's the way you're reading it through the chair, then I'm comfortable with that. My intent in appearing today and providing testimony was to try to achieve the legislative intent that we're doing right now to ensure that there's not that confusion and someone doesn't come back later on and argue the exact opposite, argue the position that I was saying, and I'm glad to hear you all saying that that's not the intent of the legislature. You only want consideration, and if you want them to be able to articulate a difference, I think they're capable of doing that. So that's good to know.
No, again, I would hope that they could articulate that difference within the standards and parameters that the council has. And so, I mean, again, I'm just wanting to make sure that my perception of this language does not anywhere include a binding requirement.
And that's exactly what I was concerned about, so we're on the same page.
You had concerns about another section, as I recall.
The other section that I would point to, quite frankly, is the clear and convincing. And I heard Senator Wilikowski's comments about wanting to ensure that there was due process. You know, my time in prosecuting law enforcement officers.
Just for a second, I think you and Senator Wilikowski know the bill better than I do.
Section 2, thank you.
You're welcome.
Two lines.
Got it.
That particular section, and you talk about due process, you know, in my time in prosecuting officers, one of the things that I've given considerable thought to is the notion that we ought to hold those people in public service and in law enforcement, quite frankly, to a higher standard than everyone else. Allow me a moment to explain that thought process. This is something I've been giving consideration to for the better part of the last 2 years. The idea is this. In our society, it's a society that's based upon trust. We trust that other people are not going to be breaking the law. And if they do, we trust that law enforcement officers are going to be there to investigate them, to help hold those people accountable, and prosecutors will come in and do the same thing. When someone breaks the law, there is a breakdown in some trust. But when the person who breaks the law is a law enforcement officer or someone that is in that public service, that violation of trust is twofold. Because now it's not just that the law was broken, but the person who's supposed to be upholding it has broken it. That's a fairly significant aspect, and it took me some time to be able to articulate this. I'll tell you, I didn't do that on my own. I had to go to philosophy professors at the university to be able to help me work my way through some of this and really be able to understand why that's so offensive to us. We all know that if an officer breaks the law, that just really irks us. And there's a reason that we get so riled up. It's because that infringes upon our trust and our credibility that we hold in those institutions that are supposed to be protecting us. Here's how this relates to that standard. What you're saying is, and forgive me, I haven't read through the two dozen different professions that are there. And I heard the Senator Wilkowski say that some of them have a higher standard. I don't know which one of those have that higher standard. I see you raising your hand.
Just for a point of order, yeah.
Sure. Point of order, yeah, because the question was asked. We've actually requested legislative research to get us that information. My understanding is the Bar Association has a clear and convincing evidence standard, but we'll get that information and clarify it.
It's a fair consideration.
Through the chair, that's correct. The Bar Association does have a clear and convincing standard, but that is not one of the organizations that's listed under Title 44, 62, 330 through 630, which is the act that governs how all of this works. And yes, that's always governed. The fact you want to put it in this bill to make it abundantly clear that those are the rules that apply, I don't have any objection to. But the idea that you would raise the standard causes me this concern. When I look at prosecution, obviously we're dealing with beyond a reasonable doubt. But that's not what the council deals with. The council deals with those law enforcement officers that have fallen below that standard that we want to have that's consistent across the entire state. Why would you require increasing the standard of proof that the council has to have for that person having fallen below the minimum standard that we want? That is, why would you increase the burden of proof to show that someone's not performing the way we want as a law enforcement officer? That, in my mind, says that you would decrease the ability to trust and have reliability and faith in that institution of law enforcement. If you start with the premise that you've got those members of the council that are of the utmost integrity, some of the folks that you all were considering just earlier today in those appointments, knowing that those are the people making these decisions, knowing that those are the people that are concerned with fostering good, hardworking, honest, qualified members in the law enforcement and correctional community, when those are the people that are taking a look at those things, why would you then say, well, we don't trust your credibility, we don't trust your discretion, and we actually want to increase the burden of proof that you have to have? That seems counterproductive to me.
It's a good argument, and and it's skillfully made. I want to give the PSEA folks at least 5 minutes to respond while we're still on the record. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. I don't mean to cut you off.
Those are my comments. The last thing I would tell you is, though I'm not normally here in Juneau, I can be available by phone should you have any additional questions, and you all know how to reach my department.
This bill is not leaving right now, but I do want to. We do have Mr. Metcalf here.
Absolutely.
And we've had two strong witnesses now from the PSEA. Mr. Sorensen, actually, you're the person I think they want to have come forward. But why don't you both come forward, put yourselves on the record, and we'll. You can see the time pressure we're under, and I apologize, but we do appreciate you being here and wanting to make time for you.
I understand the time pressure, and I'll try to make it quick. My name is Jake Metcalf. I'm executive director for PSEA Local 803. We represent about 800 certified and non-certified police department employees. Just to give you a little background, I'm a former colleague of Mr. Skidmore. I served as an assistant district attorney and district attorney I also worked with Mr. Skidmore in the Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals as a Deputy Attorney General. In addition to that, I spent 12 years as a labor attorney, as an associate general counsel and general counsel. And in both of those capacities as a prosecutor and a labor lawyer, I prosecuted, I think, right around 50 trials, mostly unclassified and Class A felony trials, which required a burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. In the labor setting, I did over 100 arbitration hearings, most of them dealing with discipline, which at its lowest burden required a clear and convincing standard. So I've had experiences in both of those areas, and I'd like to talk specifically about the burden of proof and consideration of prior arbitration decisions, which Mr. Skidmore touched on, and give you a little background on why we think this bill is necessary and why we support it. We've, in my time at PSEA, had three cases that were gone through a grievance process and went to arbitration hearing, where the arbitrator ruled that employer had not proved the discipline that was alleged, and these are termination cases where officers had been terminated. So they got their jobs back, according to the arbitrator. The state, and in this case it was two troopers and an airport police officer, so they're state employees. The state challenged that in the Superior Court. In each of the three cases, the state lost at the Superior Court. Superior Court said arbitrator made the right decision. Two of those cases went to the Supreme Court, and the third is probably on its way. But in the two cases that went to the Supreme Court said the arbitrator made the right decision, Superior Court made the right decision, the employee should get his job back. A couple of those cases went to the council. The council revoked one certificate, and a hearing officer said you can't revoke the certificate because the burden of proof wasn't there by preponderance, because the council follows a preponderance standard. But let's talk about just that level of proof. The facts don't change when it goes from arbitration to the council. And I also want to talk about the investigations that are done, because I know, Mr. Chair, you're a former prosecutor. When discipline is taking place of a police officer, there is an investigation, much like a criminal case, that takes place. Witnesses are interviewed. Witnesses can be required to take a polygraph test or be offered a polygraph test. There are all kinds of investigative techniques that are used by trained people in investigative procedures. So this is unlike another private employee discipline case where you have human resource people doing the investigation. So the facts that the council gets are a police department investigation that don't change between the discipline hearing and the hearing before the council to revoke the certificate. But I just also want to point out that the standard at the arbitration level is clear and convincing at the lowest standard. I oftentimes argued for beyond a reasonable doubt because, as Senator Wilikowski said, it's economic capital punishment. And just to go back to something Mr. Sexton said, he said they've only revoked six certificates. Well, if one wrong decision is made in a situation where there's economic capital punishment, that person who suffers from that wrong decision is ruined in that career for the rest of their lives. They're not going to get a certificate back. So it's much like capital punishment. You can't make an error, otherwise you affect the person forever. Clear and convincing standard is not a real difficult standard, and I've prosecuted cases at the reasonable doubt standard, and I've done cases that required clear and convincing. And when the facts don't change, it's not a real difficult situation for the council to, one, pay attention to the arbitration decision and the court decisions, and then require the same standard that's been followed through the employment procedure. Those are all my comments. I'm available for questions, but Mr. Sorensen may have comments as well.
You've probably got about 2 to 3 minutes, so put yourself on the record and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity, but I believe your time is better spent just considering the merits of this bill and the testimony that's been taken. Thank you.
I don't think I'll try to argue you out of your position. Senator Wilkowski.
And Mr. Chair, I don't know if your plans are to bring this back up. We've got more witnesses online. I'd like to hear at some point a little bit more about the photographs, the positions on that. And also, if you could address it maybe next time, the concerns raised by the Police Standards Council about just the public trust, because I think, you know, you do have this balancing test, and how you sort of weigh the public trust versus the employees' right to have due process.
I frankly hear dialogue happening. You know, I appreciate that. The dialogues don't have to happen in committee; they can happen in offices or over the telephone. I appreciate your willingness to come down here, and likewise to Mr. Skidmore and to Mr. Sexton. It's really helpful to have people here in person. And so I'm not meaning to cut anybody off, but I know every single person on this committee has to be somewhere else right now.
Mr. Chair, I just want to let the committee know that we had a number of members online to testify. I know people are sending in their testimony by email.
We are not done with public testimony on this bill.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thank you. Well, with that, we're adjourned.